Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Media Answers Network, and is sponsored by the law offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here's your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Jen Horenjeff, CEO and co-founder at Savvy Co-op. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks so much for having me.
So it's great to have you on the show. And what I always like to do before diving into the main part of the conversation is to let each of my guests have a chance to give a little bit more of an introduction in terms of who they are and what they do. So the floor is yours.
Thanks. I would be happy to give a little intro. I have a sort of meandering path, but I'll try to package it up. So I consider myself first and foremost a patient. I grew up with several different chronic illnesses, most notably juvenile idiopathic arthritis. I was diagnosed as an infant. So that's really my lens in healthcare. But I then became a human factors engineer and human-centered designer. I got my PhD in environmental medicine, which is loaded. I studied patient-centered outcomes and how to make sure clinical trials or treatment guidelines included things that mattered to patients. I was an FDA advisor as well. And all of these things sort of informed what ultimately ended up being Savvy Cooperative, which is a patient-owned co-op that helps to connect companies or innovators directly with patients or caregivers so that they can hear from the people they're trying to serve so we can actually make better products and services rather than just guessing. And so I am the proud founder and CEO of Savvy.
So I think you already started to answer what's usually my next question, of which is, how did you get into the healthcare industry? And, you know, kind of as you already highlighted, it's basically been your whole life. So I'm going to reframe it a little bit and ask, how did you choose which specific kind of angle that you've taken within the industry?
It's a really good question. I mean, you know, growing up a sick kid, I'm one of many that think they're going to grow up to be a doctor. So I was more on like a physician track. I was pre-med in college and undergrad. But truthfully, I was sort of disenchanted from being a provider because I saw the limitations that my providers were facing because of our healthcare system. They couldn't even practice the medicine that they wanted to. So I figured perhaps there was another way I could get involved and help. And as somebody with arthritis and limited impairments and seeing my community, it really drew me to human factors. I was actually a professional dancer as well. Kind of my whole MO in life is if somebody tells me I can't do something, then I go and double down on it. So with arthritis growing up in the 80s, the philosophy back then was don't move. You know, you should just stay still, protect your joints. And instead, my parents enrolled me in dance just to kind of get me out of the house. And so I really kind of leaned into that. So I've always just had this interest in health and how can we make sure that people who have various conditions or abilities are still able to do the things that they want to do. And that's what then sort of transformed into doing patient-centered outcomes and making sure we're understanding what matters to patients. And that was sort of this meandering path. I certainly never thought I was going to start a company. I probably wouldn't have gone through a PhD process that was horrendous had I known that I would not end up using it as the way I originally contemplated. But it was really then, you know, seeing the need that we needed to have a better streamlined process for these innovators to connect directly with patients. And as a cooperative now, I just didn't think that everybody was going to take the same sort of thoughtful approach to make sure that patients were equitably valued. So I really felt sort of this responsibility to do this in order to make sure that when we're doing this kind of work, that patients are not just quote unquote at the center, they're truly the ones that are powering, that are owning the organization that we're building.
So you've mentioned a couple of times human factors. I think you said that was part of one or multiple of your degrees and that it was an interest of yours. So can you kind of explain exactly what that means and then how that's influenced, you know, kind of the work that you're focusing on at Savvy as well as the patients, really creating a really truly patient-centered model?
Yeah. So human factors is really the science of trying to fit the world or objects and things in it to the person as opposed to other ways around. And so, you know, I also did ergonomics. So an example for those of you who might be sitting at a desk like we are right now, you know, you have all these different tools, and depending on kind of where you put them and there's something adjustable or not, it means that like you might be contorting your body to use your stuff. And that's how you end up uncomfortable. And so in ergonomics of like a workstation, you end up making chairs that are adjustable, desks that are adjustable, keyboards that, you know, contort a little bit so that it fits somebody's body, as opposed to just like slapping you down at a random desk and chair and saying good luck. And then you end up with back pain. So that's what we want to do, like zoom way out and say, okay, well, how do we make the healthcare system work for patients, as opposed to throwing more things at them, which, you know, we can get into it, but this is what we're seeing a lot of in the pandemic, as we just keep throwing new tech and new tools at patients. And they're like, hey, wait a minute, none of these things work together. So you're actually making my life harder rather than easier.
So kind of as you just teed it up, it's, you know, thinking about how do we make the healthcare system work better for individuals, and by individuals, most likely, you know, the patients who are accessing it. What are some of the perspectives that you're looking at in order to advance that improvement?
I think it's always going to depend on what are we talking about? And I can kind of maybe lay out some examples from like a life cycle. If somebody is getting into, say, like a new therapeutic area or a new population, a lot of the time what they need to do first is to understand what are sort of the unmet needs. What is the burden of those patients? What are the problems that need to be solved? Because that's what, it can't just be a bunch of people sitting in a lab or, you know, coding at their computer, guessing what patients want and need. We need to do the work to understand what that is. So once we can understand that, then you might start to design or develop, you know, either a tool or a product or a drug or these kind of things. But you want to be able to get constant feedback on it and continue to validate your hypotheses. The most dangerous thing is that we never ask patients. We spend years developing something and then we launch it and they're like, I don't want this. I don't need this. Or this is too hard to use. And it fails. It's a lose-lose situation. The company has lost money. They've lost their time and resources. And patients are not getting the things that they need to improve their health outcomes. And so it really does benefit both sides if we can accelerate the innovation process by continually checking in with patients along the way to keep saying, are we getting it right? Are we getting it right? What else do we need? What are we missing? So that we can make the best possible product or service.
And to some degree, this is probably underselling it. But, you know, given that, you know, kind of as you're describing, pretty much everything in healthcare ends up being geared towards, should be geared towards, how do we help patients and how do we help everyone lead healthier lives? What were maybe some of the systemic barriers or systemic biases away from historically getting patients involved, since arguably it's really hard to do anything to help an individual without seeking input from that individual?
It makes so much sense when you just say that out loud, right? But that is sort of the challenge of healthcare. Healthcare has traditionally been a very paternalistic sort of sector. And it's also just sort of the way that we have evolved and have access to new information and how people want to have more autonomy. So it's not necessarily just doctor knows best anymore. People want to be able to have the information to be able to make decisions and to be able to, you know, get to the outcomes that they as individuals want. But the challenge here, or sort of the difference to contrast it with other sort of consumer industries, is just the amount of stakeholders involved in healthcare. In sort of a traditional consumer market, let's pretend you're going to, you know, you're in the market to buy a car. Well, you presumably are the one to go to the dealership, test out different cars, decide which car you want, pay for that car, and then drive that car. So it's mostly just that kind of one stakeholder driving the entire process and the one then using it. Where in healthcare, you have different stakeholders who are, you know, giving you advice, who are paying for things, who are, you know, then the lowly sort of patient at the very end who's the one that's using it. But we have all these different people that are weighing in. And that's where, when we couple that with that sort of paternalistic view that we as innovators, providers, whomever, know what's best for that patient, that's led to us not talking to them, because we just think that you should do what we say because we are the experts. And so what we're trying to do is sort of shift that power imbalance to say that patients are the experts on their experiences. They're the ones who are savvy about their condition and what that has been like. And so therefore, it's not that it replaces anybody else's expertise. We're just viewing it as an additional input of insights that is valuable so that we get the whole picture of how to create the best product or service.
Yeah, and I think the way you just phrased it of, you know, it's not a replacement, but it's an enhancement. It seems to really actually kind of be a consistent theme when you're talking about a lot of new innovations within healthcare. It's, you know, it's certainly, you know, telehealth, I think, is a big example there where it's touted maybe as, oh, it's going to do all these things. But then when you look at the reality is it's really just expanding the scope of how services can be delivered and fitting within to a continuum. Do you see the perception around that patient input kind of going through that same type of evolutionary cycle?
I think that people are coming around to it. They're seeing the value in it. I think some of the biggest barriers are getting that sort of understanding that it is valuable adopted across sort of either a company or a team or whatnot. Because, you know, when I kind of step back and think about the past decade that people have been talking about, you know, quote unquote, patient centricity, right? Like, oh, of course the patient's at the center. People have been talking about this for a very long time now, but we're trying to push them towards action. And okay, well, prove it. Prove that you care by doing the work and talking to patients. And I think one of the biggest barriers is that people are not setting aside the amount of resources that they need to do this, be it time, be it budgets. They think this stuff comes out of thin air and it just takes you putting it into your product roadmap to be able to get the work done. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges that I see people are facing and struggling with as they are trying to dip their toe into actually doing the work.
So to kind of get beyond that dipping the toe, kind of what are some of the processes or, you know, approaches that organizations can effectively take to enhance the patient voice?
And I think that's a question I get all the time. It's like, what's the perfect way to do patient engagement? And the truth is, of course, there is no one size fits all, and there's no perfect way. So I certainly see certain organizations that are kind of had that analysis paralysis of, oh, we don't know what we should do. And then there's, you know, the segment of people that are too afraid to talk to patients, oftentimes in sort of the pharmaceutical industry where it's highly regulated, and it's sort of these perceived barriers that they can't do this, which is not true. There are certain things they can't do, but for the vast majority of things around patient engagement, you know, everything is available to them. But when it comes to then thinking about what are the variety of ways that people can then tap into patient insights, it's going to look different for different, you know, stages of your roadmap. It could be going broad and doing something like a survey where you could capture large amounts of people. But, you know, when we start to do more quantitative data, it's going to lack sort of that richness of sort of the qualitative insights. I think just across the board, big data gives us more of that kind of signal that something's wrong. And we need to couple that with then doing sort of that qualitative later to ask patients, well, why are we seeing this signal? What's wrong? And how do we fix that? And doing that kind of work usually happens with things like in-depth interviews, can be focus groups. We do a lot more now online in this virtual world. So we've actually developed an online platform where we can do different activities and discussion boards and other sort of qualitative research techniques to draw out these sort of conversations. It might be having a patient come in, back when we used to be able to travel, come in and speak to a team just to kind of share some of those insights. So the team personally. So there's a lot of different ways that this can happen, and it's going to depend kind of where you are along your roadmap.
And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Jen Horn, Jeff from Savvy Co-op, and we're talking about truly creating a patient-centric model within healthcare. And Jen, kind of as we were just talking about, is saying that there's kind of like that almost, as you said, that the analysis paralysis and feeling of being overwhelmed of, you know, how do I actually get patients involved? It actually really reminds me, was actually ties directly into comments I just got within the past few days of this recording of around kind of racial bias and racial inequity training of, you know, so many organizations say, oh, I can't find a qualified person of a different racial minority or other minority class, where it's, you know, if you actually take the time to consider it, there is very many qualified candidates. Maybe you just have to take a different approach and look at it through a different lens as opposed to trying to jam that round peg into the square hole of how you've always done things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, also, if you don't know where to find a single Black or Latinx patient, that's also a red flag. And we should reevaluate sort of the relationships that you have with the industry, you know, the healthcare ecosystem, if that is something that is, you can't even identify those kinds of individuals. But I mean, this is truly actually why we started Savvy, was to be able to make it so easy and seamless to find the right targeted patients that there's no excuse not to. And as I've been, you know, doing a lot more, you know, talking about these things over the 2020 sort of summer, where a lot of things have, you know, come up and there's a lot of civil unrest around diversity, equity, and inclusion, rightfully so, you know, I've sort of likened it to what we're talking about from like patient centricity. Oh, I don't know where to find the patients. It's sort of that funnel then that kind of talking about, well, where do we find these, you know, Black, Native American, Latinx patients, the ones that are historically underrepresented, that's sort of just then narrowing it down. It's still sort of the same problem that people are saying, I don't know where to find them. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to talk to them. But now we're getting specific about a population of interest. And so it's the same sort of thing, the same things that just rewind this recording and back up to where I say, you got to put forward the effort, the time, the budget to make it happen. And so that's really kind of what our goals are at Savvy, is to make sure that people can understand how to connect with very specific types of populations, be it that they're looking for, you know, people who are Black in the South, East, who are on Medicaid and who have type 2 diabetes, that's the like kind of the way that we really help to identify the right participants, because they're there and they want to be able to share their insights. But I think one thing to note is, how do we reach those communities? Because, you know, historically, of course, we know there's been a lot of malfeasance in clinical trials back in the day in some of these communities. But part of the problem is that it's people in their ivory towers expecting, you know, these communities to come to them, or that, you know, it's an individual that doesn't belong to that community that's doing the outreach. And for those of you who are listening, you cannot see me, but I am white. And I recognize that that's not going to be the appropriate place for me either. And so what we've actually done is create sort of a different approach through our cooperative to empower members and leaders of those communities to be the ones to reach out in culturally sensitive ways, in order to engage them in a way that feels more comfortable, because it's more of a peer-to-peer outreach as opposed to, you know, company or researcher trying to reach communities that may not have the same level of trust in those professionals. And so I think it's not only are you setting aside the resources, but what is the approach that you're doing to reach those communities so that they feel like they want to be able to engage?
And that kind of just circles back around to, you know, the themes that you were saying at the beginning of taking the time to understand who you're trying to interact with, and not just trying to force your own dialogue onto it, but to truly engage in an actual back and forth where you're enhancing everyone's collaboration.
Absolutely. We want to make sure that there's more of a dialogue, a back and forth, because that's what cultivates trust. That's what makes somebody want to come back and do it again. I think, you know, oftentimes we're thinking of patients as something that we get information from. We take that information and we squirrel it away, or it goes into a vortex. The patients have no idea how it made an impact. You never follow up with them. There's no future dialogue. And it's like, well, wait, why did I do that? And so I think that that's certainly one thing to think about, is how do you make sure it's not a one and done, that you're trying to create sort of longitudinal touch points so that people understand that you are an organization that's committed to this.
And kind of, as, you know, as you just said, you know, trying to create that longitudinal perspective and connection, how do, you know, maybe more traditional, you know, labels that are placed onto individuals play a role in that? You know, and I think one of the ones that might jump readily to mind is, you know, labeling someone as non-compliant. I guess maybe not to mince words, not to say someone, but say labeling a patient as non-compliant. Kind of what does that do to the mindset both of the clinician and then the patient if they start hearing that?
Oh, this is my favorite, least favorite word. I talk about this word all the time, that it's such a misnomer in the fact that the word inherently is putting the onus on the patient as if they're the ones that are doing something wrong, when in reality, it is the system that is likely failing the patient because we have not set up things in such a streamlined way. I frequently will share one of my, you know, continuous non-compliant examples about getting my labs drawn. I'm on medications and have certain conditions, and I'm supposed to regularly get my labs drawn, just regular CBCs, just to make sure that everything looks okay. I've got great insurance. It should cover it. Should be, honestly, it ends up being like a few dollars that I get charged if it gets run through the insurance correctly, because it never does. It's always hundreds of dollars every time. And it means that I'm going to have to spend hours of my business hours trying to chase down doctors, insurance companies, and Quest Labs and all of this to reconcile it. And so I don't do it because it's too exhausting for me. So I don't get my labs drawn as I'm supposed to because the system is failing me. And so that's just one example of me being labeled as non-compliant when truly it's a you know, side effect of a system that's been designed poorly.
So kind of understanding that, what is a better way to frame it, and how does that present an opportunity to advance the more patient centricity and the collaboration between, I'm going to call it the whole care team, thinking both clinician, system, and patient?
Yeah, I wish that we had a better term. I feel like in healthcare, we're lacking for a lot of great terms and terminologies. Even, you know, what is a patient? You know, there's a lot of controversy baked into that as well. But I think it's just trying to understand that no one stakeholder can solve all of these problems. And so the more we can do sort of co-design of new processes or systems, the better off we're going to be. And truly, we're going to get there faster. Yeah, it takes time to deal with a lot of different stakeholders, but the fewer times that you're probably going to have to go back and correct things that are not working, is you're probably saving yourself a lot of time and headache in the end. But it means that you're kind of doubling down and doing the work up front.
It would also seem part of doubling down and doing that work up front is having more honesty back and forth. You know, I think this kind of also touches into, you know, I think you were mentioning a little bit, but, you know, like the note process and, you know, all the information that's in the background. So often that's only viewed from one side, and so many barriers are thrown up to prevent individuals from seeing information about themselves. But it feels like increasingly there's more and more data available showing that when everything is done in that kind of open, transparent manner, it actually improves the outcomes for everybody.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is one of those things where people talk about, oh, well, patients couldn't possibly understand their health record, so we're saving them from themselves by not showing them. And that to me is, well, I won't say expletives here, but it makes me all jazzed up because, you know, I don't understand all my financial data, yet I have access to it. And then I take this data and I go talk to an accountant about it. And that's perfectly acceptable. But yet in healthcare, we are the barriers to the patients having access to their data. So I think that you're right. We need to identify these things also with humility and invulnerability and just saying we don't have all the answers, and that's okay. But I think that, you know, there are a lot of people that are still having to sort of check their egos and understand where can they find value in working with other stakeholders.
To some degree, that the as you said, the checking of the ego, do you think that goes into the training process? You know, because it maybe historically, I'm not, maybe, you know, hopefully this is changing. It's, you know, kind of the, you know, as you said, the healthcare system has been a largely paternalistic setup where you're just supposed to trust the voice of the professional. And is training being improved to really drive more of a kind of collaborative, empathetic process?
I mean, I hope so. There is some evidence that like medical schools are bringing in patients during their education process. But, you know, these sometimes are like one-time lectures. It's not immersion. And so, you know, you hear stories of doctors who end up then getting diagnosed with cancer and their world has changed. And we don't want it to come to that for you to have that sort of understanding. I think we see this in tech as well. You know, a lot of people coming from tech who understand sort of that iterative process, but also are thinking about the whole like, oh, well, don't ask your customers. They don't know what to tell you. But, you know, it is very different than using like Facebook and trying to see how people are, you know, using that. This is talking about very specific populations who have very specific needs. And so it's not doing anybody any favors if there's this braggadocio about who has the upper hand in how we should develop these things.
In continuing to try and drive the system, you know, who do you see as kind of the most effective target audience for being able to implement you know, some of the changes that we've been talking about?
Honestly, it's at every layer. And I hate thinking about things as hierarchies, but you need people at the top of a company and sort of the leadership to be able to set sort of a cultural tone and uphold these values, to also be able to say, if you don't uphold these values, that there may be consequences on whether or not you stay at our organization. So that those people, you know, that are the project managers or things like this that want to do the work, that's the tendency I see, is that they're the ones that are trying to get by buy-in from leadership, that they have permission and resources to do this. And of course, then we need all the other joints, the different stakeholders to get on board as well. But I don't think that there's anyone of, oh, if we could just convince the XYZ title, then we'd solve all the problems. Unfortunately, there's just so many layers and stakeholders to get through.
In your description of, you know, really wanting to see a cultural change, you know, is probably something that's, you know, a theme across a lot of the topics I end up talking about, because it's, you know, if you want to see, as you said, if you really want to see embedded change, you need to have everyone buying into that. It's, you know, I often talk about it from the security and privacy context, but, you know, you can really substitute any concept in there of, you know, if you want people to buy in, that really, as you said, goes into the culture and the kind of values of an organization and a system.
Absolutely. If you're calling yourself patient-centered and you don't take the time to talk to patients, you have some soul searching to do.
Yeah, no, it's a, you know, it kind of, as you're saying, it's not an easy process, and it's not something that will happen overnight either. It, you know, it takes time. You know, kind of, believe it or not, we're already really kind of getting very close to the end of our time. So kind of one final question, and this will allow you to, you know, kind of, I think, build off of the optimism that you've been expressing, but it's kind of, what do you see as a biggest area for opportunity within healthcare, especially kind of with this period of upheaval that's been driven by the course of the COVID pandemic?
I think that right now there's a lot of people who are resetting, reevaluating, because they've had to transition either their offerings or trials or whatever it might be to respond to what is happening across the world. And so it's a great time to pause and assess how you've been doing things. What was business as usual? And is there now a different way to roll things out? And stopping and seeing that when the pandemic started, we had to respond really quickly because time was of the essence. But now, if we can just sort of take a beat and reset, it will allow people to find new processes. So I am hopeful that in light of some really terrible things that have happened this past year, there is sort of a new awakening, and it's just sort of a forced opportunity to create new processes and systems that hopefully are more equitable to patients in the end.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a very great inspirational take on it, because it often seems that, you know, out of a great disaster or negative event, that a lot of good can be developed from it. But as I said, believe it or not, we are already out of time. I want to thank my guest, Jen Orenjeff, for a great conversation today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.